These were the spacesuit's main gloves, and they were made of heavy rubber. They were the most important barrier between her and Ebola. The hands were the weak point, the most vulnerable part of the suit because of what they handled. They handled needles, knives, and sharp pieces of bone. You are responsible for maintaining your spacesuit in the same way that a paratrooper is responsible for packing and maintaining his own parachute. Perhaps Nancy was in a bit of a hurry and did not inspect her spacesuit as closely as she should have. Lieutenant Colonel Johnson gave her a short briefing on procedures and then helped her lower the helmet over her head. The helmet was made of soft, flexible plastic. Johnson looked at her face, visible through the clear faceplate, to see how she was doing. She closed an oiled Ziploc zipper across the suit's chest. The zipper made a popping sound as it snapped shut. Pop, pop, pop. The moment the spacesuit was closed, her faceplate fogged up. She reached over to a wall and pulled down a coiled yellow air hose and plugged it into her suit. Then came a roar of flowing air, and her suit bloated up, fat and hard, and a whiff of dry air cleared away some tiny beads of sweat that had collected inside her faceplate. Around the Institute, they say that you can't predict who will panic inside a biological spacesuit. It happens now and then, mainly to inexperienced people. The moment the helmet closes over their faces, their eyes begin to glitter with fear, they sweat, turn purple, claw at the suit, try to tear it open to get some fresh air, lose their balance and fall down on the floor, and they can start screaming or moaning inside the suit, which makes them sound as if they are suffocating in a closet. After he'd helped Nancy Jax put on her spacesuit and had looked into her eyes for signs of panic, Tony Johnson put on his own suit, and when he was closed up and ready, he handed her a pack of dissection tools. He seemed calm and collected. They turned and faced the stainless steel door together. The door led into an airlock and level 4. The door was plastered with a biohazard symbol and warnings. Caution. Biohazard. Do not enter without wearing ventilated suit. The international symbol for biohazard, which is pasted on doors at USAMRID, whenever they open through a major transition of zones, is a red trefoil that reminds me of a red trillium or toad shade. The level 4 airlock is a gray area, a place where two worlds meet, where the hot zone touches the normal world. The gray area is neither hot nor cold. A place that is neither provably sterile nor known to be infective. At USAMRID, toad shades bloom in the gray zones. Nancy took a breath and gathered her thoughts into stillness, using her martial arts training to get her breathing under control. People performed all kinds of little rituals before they walked through that steel door. Some people crossed themselves. Others carried amulets or charms inside their spacesuits, even though it was technically against the rules to bring anything inside the suit except your body and the surgical scrubs. They hoped the amulets might help ward off the hot agent if there was a major break in their suit. She unplugged her air hose and unlatched the steel door and entered an airlock, and Tony Johnson followed her. The airlock was made entirely of stainless steel, and it was lined with nozzles for spraying water and chemicals. This was the decon shower. Decon means decontamination. The door closed behind them. Nancy opened the far door of the airlock, and they crossed over to the hot side. Total Immersion, 1983, September 26th, 1330 hours. They were standing in a narrow, cinder-block corridor. Various rooms opened on either side. The hot zone was a maze. From the walls dangled yellow air hoses. There was an alarm strobe light on the ceiling that would be triggered if the air system failed. The walls were painted with thick, gobby epoxy paint, and all the electrical outlets were plugged around the edges with a gooey material. This was to seal any cracks and holes, so that a hot agent couldn't escape by drifting through hollow electrical conduits. Nancy reached for an air hose and plugged it into her suit. She couldn't hear anything except the roar of air in her helmet. The air rumbled so loudly in their suits that they didn't try to speak to each other. She opened a metal cabinet. Blue light streamed out of it, and she removed a pair of yellow rubber boots. They reminded her of barn boots. She slid the soft feet of her spacesuit into the boots and glanced at Johnson and caught his eye. "Ready for action, boss." They unplugged their air hoses and proceeded down the hallway and entered the monkey room. It contained two banks of cages, positioned facing each other along opposite walls of the room. Jax and Johnson replugged their hoses and peered into the cages. One bank of cages contained two isolated monkeys. They were the so-called control monkeys. They had not been injected with Ebola virus, and they were healthy. As soon as the two army officers appeared in spacesuits, the healthy monkeys went nuts. They rattled their cages and leaped around. Humans in spacesuits make monkeys nervous. They hooted and grunted. Ooh, ooh, haw, wah, ha, and they uttered a high-pitched squeal. Eek! The monkeys moved to the front of their cages and shook the doors or leaped back and forth, wump, 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 watching Jax and Johnson the whole time, following them with their eyes alert to everything. The cages had elaborate bolts on the doors to prevent fiddling by primate fingers. These monkeys were creative little boogers, she thought, and they were bored. The other bank of cages was mostly quiet. This was the bank of Ebola cages. All the monkeys in these cages were infected with Ebola virus, and most of them were silent, passive, and withdrawn, although one or two of them seemed queerly deranged. Their immune systems had failed or gone haywire. Most of the animals didn't look very sick yet, but they didn't display the alertness, the usual monkey energy, the leaping and the cage rattling that you see in healthy monkeys, and most of them had not eaten their morning biscuits. They sat almost motionless in their cages, watching the two officers with expressionless faces. They had been injected with the hottest strain of Ebola known to the world. It was the Mayinga strain of Ebola Zaire. This strain had come from a young woman named Mayinga N., who died of the virus on October 19, 1976. She was a nurse at a hospital in Zaire, and she had taken care of a Roman Catholic nun who died of Ebola. The nun had bled to death all over Nurse Mayinga, and then a few days later, Nurse Mayinga had broken with Ebola and died. Some of Nurse Mayinga's blood had ended up in the United States, and the strain of virus that had once lived in Nurse Mayinga's blood now lived in small glass vials kept in super freezers at the Institute, which were maintained at minus 160 degrees Fahrenheit. The freezers were fitted with padlocks and alarms, and were plastered with biohazard flowers and sealed with bands of sticky tape. The first line of defense against a hot agent is sticky tape, because it seals cracks. It could be said that without sticky tape, there would be no such thing as biocontainment. Jean Johnson, the civilian scientist, had thawed a little bit of Nurse Mayinga's frozen blood and had injected it into the monkeys. Then, as the monkeys became sick, he had treated them with a drug in the hope that it would help them fight off the virus. The drug did not seem to be working. Nancy Jax and Tony Johnson inspected the monkeys, moving from cage to cage, until they found the two monkeys that had crashed and bled out. Those animals were hunched up, each in its own cage. They had bloody noses and their eyes were half open, glassy and brilliant red with dilated pupils. The monkeys showed no facial expression, not even pain or agony. The connective tissue under the skin had been destroyed by the virus, causing a subtle distortion of the face. Another reason for the strange faces was that the parts of the brain that control facial expression had also been destroyed. The mask-like face, the red eyes, and the bloody nose were classic signs of Ebola that appear in all primates infected with the virus, both monkeys and humans. It hinted at a vicious combination of brain damage and soft tissue destruction under the skin. The classic Ebola face made the monkeys look as if they had seen something beyond comprehension. It was not a vision of heaven. Nancy Jacks felt a wave of unease. She was distressed by the sight of the dead and suffering monkeys. As a veterinarian, she believed that it was her duty to heal animals and relieve their suffering. As a scientist, she believed that it was her obligation to perform medical research that would help alleviate human suffering. Even though she had grown up on a farm, where her father had raised livestock for food, she had never been able to bear easily the death of an animal. As a girl, she'd cried when her father had taken her 4-H Club prize steer to the butcher. She liked animals better than many people. In taking the veterinarian's oath, she had pledged herself to a code of honor that bound her to the care of animals, but also bound her to the saving of human lives through medicine. At times in her work, those two ideals clashed. She told herself that this research was being done to help find a cure for Ebola, that it was medical research that would help save human lives and might possibly avert a tragedy for the human species. That helped reduce her feelings of unease, but not completely, and she kept her emotions off to one side. Johnson watched Jacks carefully as she began the removal procedure. Handling an unconscious monkey in level 4 is a tricky operation because monkeys can wake up, and they have teeth and a powerful bite, and they are remarkably strong and agile. The monkeys that are used in laboratories are not organ grinder monkeys. They are large, wild animals from the rainforest. A bite by an Ebola-infected monkey would almost certainly be fatal. First, Nancy inspected the monkey, looking through the bars. It was a large male, and he looked as if he was really dead. She saw that he still had his canine fangs, and that made her nervous. Ordinarily, the monkey would have had its fangs filed down for safety. For some reason, this one had enormous natural fangs. She stuck her gloved fingers through the bars and pinched the monkey's toe while she watched for any eye movement. The eyes remained fixed and staring. "Go ahead and unlock the cage," Lieutenant Colonel Johnson said. He had to shout to be heard above the roar of air in their spacesuits. She unlocked the door and slid it up until the cage gaped wide open. She inspected the monkey again. No muscle twitches. The monkey was definitely down. "All right, go ahead and move him out," Johnson said. She reached inside and caught the monkey by the upper arms and rotated him so that he was facing away from her, so that he couldn't bite her if he woke up. She pulled his arms back and held them immobile, and she lifted the monkey out of the cage. Johnson took the monkey's feet, and together they carried him over to a hatbox, a biohazard container, and they slid the monkey into it. Then they carried the hatbox to the necropsy room, shuffling slowly in their suits. They were two human primates carrying another primate. One was the master of the earth, or at least believed himself to be, and the other was a nimble dweller in trees, a cousin of the master of the earth. Both species, the human and the monkey, were in the presence of another life form, which was older and more powerful than either of them, and was a dweller in blood. Jackson Johnson moved slowly out of the room, carrying the monkey, and turned left, and then turned left again, and entered the necropsy room, and laid the monkey down on a stainless steel table. The monkey's skin was rashy and covered with red blotches, visible through his sparse hair. "Glove up," Johnson said. They put on latex rubber gloves, pulling them over the spacesuit gloves. They now wore 3 layers of gloves: the inner lining glove, the spacesuit glove, and the outer glove. Johnson said, "We'll do the checklist. Scissors, hemostats." He laid the tools in a row at the head of the table. Each tool was numbered, and he called the numbers out loud. They went to work. Using blunt-ended scissors, Johnson opened the monkey while Jax assisted with the procedure. They worked slowly and with exquisite care. They didn't use any sharp blades because a blade is a deadly object in a hot zone. A scalpel can nick your gloves and cut your fingers, and before you even feel a sensation of pain, the agent has already entered your bloodstream. Nancy handed tools to him, and she reached her fingers inside the monkey to tie off blood vessels and mop up excess blood with small sponges. The animal's body cavity was a lake of blood. It was Ebola blood, and it had run everywhere inside the animal. There had been a lot of internal hemorrhaging. The liver was swollen, and she noticed some blood in the intestines. She had to tell herself to slow her hands down. Perhaps her hands were moving too quickly. She talked herself through the procedure, keeping herself alert and centered. Keep it clean, she thought. Okay, pick up the hemostat. Clamp that artery 'cause it's leaking blood. Break off and rinse gloves. She could feel the Ebola blood through her gloves. It felt wet and slippery, even though her hands were clean and dry and dusted with baby powder. She withdrew her hands from the carcass and rinsed them in a pan of disinfectant called Envirochem, which sat in a sink. The liquid was pale green, the color of Japanese green tea. It destroys viruses. As she rinsed her gloves in it, the liquid turned brown with monkey blood. All she could hear was the noise of the air blowing inside her suit. It filled her suit with a roar like a subway train coming through a tunnel. A virus is a small capsule made of membranes and proteins. The capsule contains one or more strands of DNA or RNA, which are long molecules that contain the software program for making a copy of the virus. Some biologists classify viruses as life forms because they are not strictly known to be alive. Viruses are ambiguously alive, neither alive nor dead. They carry on their existence in the borderlands between life and non-life. Viruses that are outside cells merely sit there. Nothing happens. They're dead. They can even form crystals. Virus particles that lie around in blood or mucus may seem dead, but the particles are waiting for something to come along. They have a sticky surface. If a cell comes along and touches the virus, and the stickiness of the virus matches the stickiness of the cell, then the virus clings to the cell. The cell feels the virus sticking to it, and enfolds the virus and drags it inside. Once the virus enters the cell, it becomes a Trojan horse. It switches on and begins to replicate. A virus is a parasite. It can't live on its own. It can only make copies of itself inside a cell using the cell's materials and machinery to get the job done. All living things carry viruses in their cells. Even fungi and bacteria are inhabited by viruses and are occasionally destroyed by them. That is, diseases have their own diseases. A virus makes copies of itself inside a cell until eventually the cell gets pigged with virus and pops, and the viruses spill out of the broken cell. Or, viruses can bud through a cell wall like drips coming out of a faucet. Drip, 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 drip. Copy, 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 copy. That's the way the AIDS virus works. The faucet runs and runs until the cell is exhausted, consumed, and destroyed. If enough cells are destroyed, the host dies. A virus does not want to kill its host. That is not in the best interest of the virus, because then the virus may also die, unless it can jump fast enough out of the dying host into a new host. The genetic code inside Ebola is a single strand of RNA. This type of molecule is thought to be the oldest and most primitive coding mechanism for life. The Earth's primordial ocean, which came into existence not long after the Earth was formed, about 4.5 billion years ago, may well have contained microscopic life forms based on RNA. This suggests that Ebola is an ancient kind of life, perhaps nearly as old as the Earth itself. Another hint that Ebola is extremely ancient is the way in which it can seem neither quite alive nor quite unalive. Viruses may seem alive when they multiply, but in another sense they are obviously dead, are only machines, subtle ones to be sure, but strictly mechanical, no more alive than a jackhammer. Viruses are molecular sharks, a motive without a mind. Compact, hard, logical, totally selfish, the virus is dedicated to making copies of itself, which it can do on occasion with radiant speed. The prime directive is to replicate. Viruses are too small to be seen. Here's a way to imagine the size of a virus. Consider the island of Manhattan shrunk to the size of a splinter about a 1/16 of an inch long. This Manhattan could easily hold 9 million viruses. If you could magnify this Manhattan, and if it were full of viruses, you would see little figures clustered like the lunch crowd on Fifth Avenue. 100 million crystallized polio viruses could cover the period at the end of this sentence. There could be 250 Woodstock festivals of viruses sitting on that period, the combined populations of Great Britain and France, and you would never know it. Keep it clean, Nancy thought. No blood. No blood. I don't like blood. Every time I see a drop of blood, I see a billion viruses. Break off and rinse. Break off and rinse. Slow yourself. Look at Tony's suit. Check him. You watched your partner's suit for any sign of a hole or a break. It was kind of like being a mother and watching your kid. A constant background check to see if everything is okay. Meanwhile, Johnson was checking her. He observed her for any kind of mistake, any jerkiness with the tools. He wondered if he would see her drop something. "Rongeur," he said. "What?" she asked. He pointed at her air hose to suggest that she crimp it so that she could hear him better. She grabbed the hose and folded it. The air stopped flowing. Her suit deflated around her, and the noise died away. He put his helmet close to hers and spoke the word "rongeur" again, and she released her hose. She handed him a pair of pliers called the rongeur. The word is French and means gnar. It's used for opening skulls. Getting into a skull is always a bitch in level 4. A primate's skull is hard and tough, and the bone plates are knitted together. Ordinarily, you would whip through a skull with an electric bone saw, but you can't use a bone saw in level 4. It would throw a mist of bone particles and blood droplets into the air, and you don't want to create any kind of infective mist in a hot area, even if you are wearing a spacesuit. It's just too dangerous. They popped the skull with the pliers. It made a loud cracking sound. They removed the brain, eyes, and spinal cord, and dropped them into a jar of preservative. Johnson was handing her a tube containing a sample when he stopped and looked at her gloved hands. He pointed to her right glove. She glanced down. Her glove. It was drenched in blood. But now she saw the hole. It was a rip across the palm of the outer glove on her right hand. Nancy tore off the glove. Now her main suit glove was covered with blood. It spidered down the outer sleeve of her spacesuit. Great. Just great. Ebola blood all over my suit. She rinsed her glove and arm in the disinfectant, and they came up clean and shiny wet. Then she noticed that her hand inside the two remaining gloves felt cold and clammy. There was something wet inside her spacesuit glove. She wondered if that glove was a leaker, too. She wondered if she had sustained a breach in her right main glove. She inspected that glove carefully. Then she saw it. It was a crack in the wrist. She had a breach in her spacesuit. Her hand felt wet. She wondered if there might be Ebola blood inside her spacesuit, somewhere close to that cut on the palm of her hand. She pointed to her glove and said, "Hole." Johnson bent over and inspected her glove. He saw the crack in the wrist. She saw his face erupt in surprise, and then he looked into her eyes. She saw that he was afraid. That terrified her. She jerked her thumb toward the exit. "I'm out of here, man. Can you finish?" He replied, "I want you to leave immediately. I'll secure the area and follow you out." Using only her left hand, her good hand, she unplugged her suit from the air hose. She practically ran down the corridor to the airlock, her right arm hanging rigidly at her side. She didn't want to move that hand because every time she moved it, she felt something squishing around in there, inside the glove. Fear threatened to overwhelm her. How was she going to remove her boots without using her bad hand? She kicked them off. They went flying down the corridor. She threw open the airlock door and stepped inside and slammed the door behind her. She pulled a chain that hung from the ceiling of the airlock. That started the decon shower. The decon shower takes 7 minutes, and you aren't permitted to leave during that period because the shower needs time to work on viruses. First came a blast of water jets, which washed traces of blood from her spacesuit. The water jets stopped. Then came a spray of EnviroChem coming out of nozzles all up and down the sides of the airlock, which deconned her spacesuit. Of course, if something lived inside her glove, the chemical shower wouldn't reach it. There were no lights in the airlock. It was dim, almost dark. The place was literally a gray zone. She wished it had a clock. Then you would know how long you would have to wait. 5 minutes to go? 4 minutes? Chemical mist drizzled down her faceplate. It was like driving a car in the rain when the windshield wipers are broken. You can't see a thing. Shit, 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 she thought. At the Institute, there is a level 4 biocontainment hospital called the Slammer, where a patient can be treated by doctors and nurses wearing spacesuits. If you are exposed to a hot agent and you go into the Slammer and fail to come out alive, then your body is taken to a nearby level 4 biocontainment morgue, known as the submarine. The soldiers around the Institute call the morgue the submarine because its main door is made of heavy steel and looks like a pressure door in a submarine. Son of a bitch, she thought. Aw, fuck. They'll put me into the Slammer. And Tony will be filling out accident reports while I'm breaking with Ebola. And a week later, I'll be in the submarine. Shit, Jerry's in Texas, and I didn't go to the bank today. There's no money in the house. The kids are home with Mrs. Trepane, and she needs to be paid. I didn't go to the market today. There's no food in the house. How are the kids going to eat if I'm in the Slammer? Who's going to stay with them tonight? Shit, shit, shit. The shower stopped. She opened the door and flung herself into the staging area. She came out of the spacesuit fast. She shucked it. She leaped out of it. The spacesuit slapped to the concrete floor, wet, dripping with water. As her right arm came out of the suit, she saw that the sleeve of her scrub suit was dark wet, and her inner glove was red. That spacesuit glove had been a leaker. Ebola blood had run over her innermost glove. It had smeared down on the latex, right against her skin, right against the Band-Aid. Her last glove was thin and translucent, and she could see the Band-Aid through it, directly under the Ebola blood. Her heart pounded, and she almost threw up. Her stomach contracted and turned over, and she felt a gag reflex in her throat. The puke factor. It's a sudden urge to throw up when you find yourself unprotected in the presence of a biosafety level 4 organism. Her mind raced. Oh, shit, what now? I've got an undeconned glove. Ebola blood in here. Oh, Jesus, what's the procedure here? What do I have to do now? Tony Johnson's blue figure moved in the airlock, and she heard the nozzles begin to hiss. He had begun the decon cycle. It would be 7 minutes before he could answer any questions. The main question was whether any blood had penetrated the last glove to the cut. 5 or 10 Ebola virus particles suspended in a droplet of blood could easily slip through a pinhole in a surgical glove, and that might be enough to start an explosive infection. This stuff could amplify itself. A pinhole in a glove might not be visible to the eye. She went over to the sink and put her hand under the faucet to rinse off the blood and held it there for a while. The water carried the blood down the drain, where the wastewater would be cooked in heated tanks. Then she pulled off the last glove, holding it delicately by the cuff. Her right hand came out caked with baby powder. Her fingernails short, no nail polish, no rings, knuckles scarred by a bite from a goat that had nipped her when she was a child, and a Band-Aid on the palm. She saw blood mixed with the baby powder. "Please, please make it my blood." Yes, it was her own blood. She had bled around the edges of the Band-Aid. She didn't see any monkey blood on her hand. She put the last glove under the faucet. The water was running, and it filled up the glove. The glove swelled up like a water balloon. She dreaded the sudden appearance of a thread of water squirting from the glove, the telltale of a leak, a sign that her life was over. The glove fattened and held. No leaks. Suddenly, her legs collapsed. She fell against the cinder block wall and slid down it, feeling as if she had been punched in the stomach. She came to rest on the hat box, the biohazard box that someone had been using as a chair. Her legs kicked out, and she went limp and leaned back against the wall. That was how Tony Johnson found her when he emerged from the airlock. The accident report concluded that Major N. Jax had not been exposed to Ebola virus. Her last glove had remained intact, and since everyone believed that the agent was transmitted through direct contact with blood and bodily fluids, there didn't seem to be any way for it to have entered her bloodstream, even though it had breached her spacesuit. She drove home that night, having escaped the slammer by the skin of her last glove. She had almost caught Ebola from a dead monkey, who had caught it from a young woman named Mayinga, who had caught it from a nun who had crashed and bled out in the jungles of Zaire in years gone by. She called Jerry that night in Texas. "Guess what? I had this little problem today. I had a near Ebola experience." She told him what had happened. He was appalled. "God damn it, Nancy. I told you not to get involved with that Ebola virus, that fucking Ebola." And he went into a 10-minute diatribe about the dangers of doing hot work in a spacesuit, especially with Ebola. She remained calm and didn't argue with him. She realized he wasn't angry with her, just scared. She let Jerry run on, and when he'd gotten it all out of his system and was starting to taper off, she told him that she felt confident that everything was going to be all right. Meanwhile, he was surprised at how calm his wife seemed. He would have flown home that night if he'd perceived any inkling of distress in her. The Ebola experiments were not a success in the sense that the drugs had no effect on the virus. All of Gene Johnson's infected monkeys died no matter what drugs they were given. They all died. The virus absolutely nuked the monkeys. It was a complete slate wiper. The only survivors of the experiment were the two control monkeys, the healthy, uninfected monkeys that lived in cages across the room from the sick monkeys. The control monkeys had not been infected with Ebola, and so, as expected, they hadn't become sick. Then, 2 weeks after the incident with the bloody glove, something frightening happened in the Ebola rooms. The two healthy monkeys developed red eyes and bloody noses, and they crashed and bled out. They had never been deliberately infected with Ebola virus, and they hadn't come near the sick monkeys. They were separated from the sick monkeys by open floor. If a healthy person were placed on the other side of a room from a person who was sick with AIDS, the AIDS virus wouldn't be able to drift across the room through the air and infect the healthy person. But Ebola had drifted across a room. It had moved quickly, decisively, and by an unknown route. Most likely, the control monkeys inhaled it into their lungs. "It got there somehow," Nancy Jacks would say to me as she told me the story some years later. "Monkeys spit and throw stuff. And when the caretakers wash the cages down with water hoses, that can create an aerosol of droplets. It probably traveled through the air in aerosolized secretions." That was when I knew that Ebola can travel through the air. Ebola River, 1976, summer through autumn. On July 6, 1976, 500 miles northwest of Mount Elgon, in southern Sudan, near the fingered edge of the Central African rainforest, a man who is known to Ebola hunters as UG went into shock and died with blood running from the orifices of his body. He is referred to only by his initials. Mr. UG was the first identified case, the index case, in an outbreak of an unknown virus. Mr. UG was a storekeeper in a cotton factory in the town of Unzara. The population of Unzara had grown in recent years. The town had experienced, in its own way, the human population explosion that's occurring throughout the equatorial regions of the earth. The people of that area in southern Sudan are the Zandi, a large tribe. The country of the Zandi is savanna mixed with riverine forest, beautiful country, where acacia trees cluster along the banks of seasonal rivers. African doves perch in the trees and call their drawn-out calls. The land between the rivers is a sea of elephant grass, which can grow 10 feet high. As you head south toward Zaire, the land rises and forms hills, and the forest begins to spread away from the rivers and thickens into a closed canopy, and you enter the rainforest. The land around the town of Unzara held rich plantations of teak and fruit trees and cotton. People were poor, but they worked hard and raised large families and kept to their tribal traditions. Mr. UG was a salaried man. He worked at a desk in a room piled with cotton cloth at the back of the factory. Bats roosted in the ceiling of the room near his desk. If the bats were infected with Ebola, no one has been able to prove it. The virus may have entered the cotton factory by some unknown route, perhaps in insects trapped in the cotton fibers, for example, or in rats that lived in the factory. Or possibly the virus had nothing to do with the cotton factory, and Mr. UG was infected somewhere else. He didn't go to a hospital and died on a cot in his family compound. His family gave him a traditional Zandi funeral and left his body under a mound of stones in a clearing of elephant grass. His grave has been visited more than once by doctors from Europe and America who want to see it and reflect on its meaning and pay their respects to the index case of what later became known as Ebola Sudan. He's remembered today as a quiet, unremarkable man. No photograph was taken of him during his lifetime, and no one seems to remember what he looked like. He wasn't well known, even in his hometown. They say that his brother was tall and slender, so perhaps he was too. He passed through the gates of life unnoticed by anyone except his family and a few of his co-workers. He might have made no difference, except for the fact that he was a host. His illness began to copy itself. A few days after he died, two other salaried men who worked at desks near him in the same room broke with bleeding, went into shock, and died with massive hemorrhages from the natural openings of the body. One of the dead men was a popular fellow known as PG, unlike the quiet Mr. Yu-ji, he had a wide circle of friends, including several mistresses. He spread the agent far and wide in the town. The agent jumped easily from person to person, apparently through touching and sexual contact. It was a fast spreader, and it could live easily in people. It passed through as many as 16 generations of infection as it jumped from person to person in Sudan. It also killed many of its hosts. While this isn't necessarily in the best interest of the virus, if the virus is highly contagious and can jump fast enough from host to host, then it does not matter really what happens to the previous host, because the virus can amplify itself for quite a while, at least until it kills off much of the population of hosts. Most of the fatal cases of Ebola Sudan can be traced back through chains of infection to the quiet Mr. Yu-G. A hot strain radiated out of him and nearly devastated the human population of southern Sudan. The strain burned through the town of Unzara and reached eastward to the town of Maridi, where there was a hospital. It hit the hospital like a bomb. It savaged patients and snaked like chain lightning out from the hospital through patients' families. Apparently, the medical staff had been giving patients injections with dirty needles. The virus jumped quickly through the hospital via the needles, and then it hit the medical staff. A characteristic of a lethal, contagious, and incurable virus is that it quickly gets into the medical people. In some cases, the medical system may intensify the outbreak, like a lens that focuses sunlight on a heap of tinder. The virus transformed the hospital at Maridi into a morgue. As it jumped from bed to bed, killing patients left and right, doctors began to notice signs of mental derangement, psychosis, depersonalization, zombie-like behavior. Some of the dying stripped off their clothes and ran out of the hospital, naked and bleeding, and wandered through the streets of the town, seeking their homes, not seeming to know what had happened or how they had gotten into this condition. There's no doubt that Ebola damages the brain and causes psychotic dementia. It's not easy, however, to separate brain damage from the effects of fear. If you were trapped in a hospital where people were dissolving in their beds, you might try to escape. And if you were a bleeder and frightened, you might take off your clothes and people might think you'd gone mad. The Sudan strain was more than twice as lethal as Marburg virus. Its case fatality rate was 50%. That is, fully half of the people who came down with it ended up dying, and quickly. This was the same kind of fatality rate as was seen with the Black Plague during the Middle Ages. If the Ebola Sudan virus had managed to spread out of Central Africa, it might have entered Khartoum in a few weeks, penetrated Cairo a few weeks after that, and from there it would have hopped to Athens, New York, Paris, London, Singapore. It would have gone everywhere on the planet. Yet that never happened, and the crisis in Sudan passed away unnoticed by the world at large. What happened in Sudan could be compared to the secret detonation of an atomic bomb. If the human race came close to a major biological accident, we never knew it. For reasons that are not clear, the outbreak subsided and the virus vanished. The hospital at Maridi had been the epicenter of the emergence. As the virus ravaged the hospital, the surviving medical staff panicked and ran off into the bush. It was probably the wisest thing to do, and the best thing that could have happened, because it stopped the use of dirty needles and emptied the hospital, which helped to break the chain of infection. There was another possible reason why the Ebola Sudan virus vanished. It was exceedingly hot. It killed people so fast that they didn't have much time to infect other people before they died. Furthermore, the virus was not airborne. It was not quite contagious enough to start a full-scale disaster. It traveled in blood, and the bleeding victim didn't touch very many other people before dying, and so the virus didn't have many chances to jump to a new host. Had people been coughing the virus into the air, it would have been a different story. In any case, the Ebola Sudan virus destroyed a few hundred people in Central Africa the way a fire consumes a pile of straw, until the blaze burns out at the center and ends in a heap of ash. Rather than smoldering around the planet, as AIDS has done, like a fire in a coal mine, impossible to put out. The Ebola virus, in its Sudan incarnation, retreated to the heart of the bush, where undoubtedly it lives to this day, cycling and cycling in some unknown host, able to shift its shape, able to mutate and become a new thing, with the potential to enter the human species in a new form. 2 months after the start of the Sudan emergence. The time was now early September 1976. An even more lethal filovirus emerged 500 miles to the west, in a district of northern Zaire called Bumba Zone, an area of tropical rainforest populated by scattered villages and drained by the Ebola River. The Ebola Zaire strain was nearly twice as lethal as Ebola Sudan. It seemed to emerge out of the stillness of an implacable force brooding on an inscrutable intention. To this day, the first human case of Ebola Zaire has never been identified. In the first days of September, some unknown person who probably lived somewhere to the south of the Ebola River perhaps touched something bloody. It might have been monkey meat. People in that area hunt monkeys for food. Or it might have been the meat of some other animal, such as an elephant or a bat. Or perhaps the person touched a crushed insect. Or perhaps he or she was bitten by a spider. Whatever the original host of the virus, it seems that a blood-to-blood contact in the rainforest enabled the virus to move into the human world. The portal into the human race may well have been a cut on this unknown person's hand. The virus surfaced in the Yambuku Mission Hospital, an upcountry clinic run by Belgian nuns. The hospital was a collection of corrugated tin roofs and whitewashed concrete walls sitting beside a church in the forest where bells rang and you heard a sound of hymns and the words of the High Mass spoken in Bantu. Next door, people stood in line at the clinic and shivered with malaria while they waited for a nun to give them an injection of medicine that might make them feel better. The mission in Yambuku also ran a school for children. In late August, a teacher from the school and some friends went on a vacation trip to the northern part of Zaire. They borrowed a Land Rover from the mission to make their journey, and they explored the country as they headed northward, moving slowly along rutted tracks, no doubt getting stuck in the mud from time to time, which is the way things go when you try to drive through Zaire. The track was mostly a footpath enclosed by a canopy of trees, and it was always in shadow, as if they were driving through a tunnel. Eventually, they came to the Ebola River and crossed it on a ferry barge and continued northward. Near the Obangi River, they stopped at a roadside market, where the schoolteacher bought some fresh antelope meat. One of his friends bought a freshly killed monkey and put it in the back of the Land Rover. Any of the friends could have handled the monkey or the antelope meat while they were bouncing around in the Land Rover. They turned back, and when the schoolteacher arrived home, his wife stewed the antelope meat, and everyone in the family ate it. The following morning he felt unwell, and so before he reported to his teaching job at the school, he stopped off at the Yambuku Hospital on the other side of the church to get an injection of medicine from the nuns. At the beginning of each day, the nuns at Yambuku Hospital would lay out 5 hypodermic syringes on a table, and they would use them to give shots to patients all day long. They were using 5 needles a day to give injections to hundreds of people in the hospitals, outpatient, and maternity clinics. The nuns and staff occasionally rinsed the needles in a pan of warm water after an injection to get the blood off the needle, but more often they proceeded from shot to shot without rinsing the needle, moving from arm to arm, mixing blood with blood. Since Ebola virus is highly infective, and since as few as 5 or 10 particles of the virus in a blood-borne contact can start an extreme amplification in a new host. There would have been excellent opportunity for the agent to spread. A few days after the schoolteacher received his injection, he broke with Ebola Zaire. He was the first known case of Ebola Zaire, but he may well have contracted the virus from a dirty needle during his injection at the hospital, which means that someone else might have previously visited the hospital while sick with Ebola virus, and earlier in the day received an injection from the same needle that was then used on the schoolteacher. That unknown person probably stood in line for an injection just ahead of the schoolteacher. That person would have started the Ebola outbreak in Zaire. As in Sudan, the emergence of a life form that could in theory have gone around the earth began with one infected person. The virus erupted simultaneously in 55 villages surrounding the hospital. First, it killed people who had received injections, and then it moved through families, killing family members, particularly women, who in Africa prepare the dead for burial. It swept through the Yambuku Hospital's nursing staff, killing most of the nurses, and then it hit the Belgian nuns. The first nun to break with Ebola was a midwife who had delivered a stillborn child. The mother was dying of Ebola and had given the virus to her unborn baby. The fetus had evidently crashed and bled out inside the mother's womb. The woman then aborted spontaneously, and the nun, who assisted at this grotesque delivery, came away from the experience with blood on her hands. The blood of the mother and fetus was radiantly hot, and the nun must have had a small break or cut on the skin of her hands. She developed an explosive infection and was dead in 5 days. There was a nun at the Yambuku Hospital who is known today as Sister M.E. She became gravely ill with l'épidémie, or the epidemic, as they had begun to call it. A priest at Yambuku decided to try to take her to the city of Kinshasa, the capital of Zaire, in order to get her better medical treatment. He and another nun, named Sister E.R., drove Sister M.E. in a Land Rover to the town of Bumba, a sprawl of cinder blocks and wooden shacks that huddles beside the Congo River. They went to the airfield at Bumba and hired a small plane to fly them to Kinshasa. And when they reached the city, they took Sister M.E. to Ngaliema Hospital, a private hospital run by Swedish nurses, where she was given a room of her own. There, she endured her agonies and committed her soul to Christ. Ebola Zaire attacks every organ and tissue in the human body except skeletal muscle and bone. It's a perfect parasite because it transforms virtually every part of the body into a digested slime of virus particles. The 7 mysterious proteins that assemble together make up the Ebola virus particle work as a relentless machine, a molecular shark, and they consume the body as the virus makes copies of itself. Small blood clots begin to appear in the bloodstream, and the blood thickens and slows, and the clots begin to stick to the walls of blood vessels. This is known as pavementing, because the clots fit together in a mosaic. The mosaic thickens and throws more clots, and the clots drift through the bloodstream into the small capillaries, where they get stuck. This shuts off the blood supply to various parts of the body, causing dead spots to appear in the brain, liver, kidneys, lungs, intestines, testicles, breast tissue, of men as well as women, and all through the skin. The skin develops red spots, called petechiae, which are hemorrhages under the skin. Ebola attacks connective tissue with particular ferocity. It multiplies in collagen, the chief constituent protein of the tissue that holds the organs together. The 7 Ebola proteins somehow chew up the body's structural proteins. In this way, collagen in the body turns to mush, and the underlayers of the skin die and liquefy. The skin bubbles up into a sea of tiny white blisters, mixed with red spots known as macula-papular rash. This rash has been likened to tapioca pudding. Spontaneous rips appear in the skin, and hemorrhagic blood pours from the rips. The red spots on the skin grow and spread and merge to become huge, spontaneous bruises, and the skin goes soft and pulpy, and can tear off if it's touched with any kind of pressure. Your mouth bleeds, and you bleed around your teeth, and you may have hemorrhages from the salivary glands. Literally, every opening in the body bleeds, no matter how small. The surface of the tongue turns brilliant red and then sloughs off and is swallowed or spat out. It's said to be extraordinarily painful to lose the surface of one's tongue. The tongue's skin may be torn off during rushes of the black vomit. The back of the throat and the lining of the windpipe may also slough off, and the dead tissue slides down the windpipe into the lungs or is coughed up with sputum. Your heart bleeds into itself. The heart muscle softens and has hemorrhages into its chambers, and blood squeezes out of the heart muscle as the heart beats, and it floods the chest cavity. The brain becomes clogged with dead blood cells, a condition known as sludging of the brain. Ebola attacks the lining of the eyeball, and the eyeballs may fill up with blood. You may go blind. Droplets of blood stand out on the eyelids. You may weep blood. The blood runs from your eyes down your cheeks and refuses to coagulate. You may have a hemispherical stroke, in which one whole side of the body is paralyzed, which is invariably fatal in a case of Ebola. Even while the body's internal organs are becoming plugged with coagulated blood, the blood that streams out of the body cannot clot. It resembles whey being squeezed out of curds. The blood has been stripped of its clotting factors. If you put the runny Ebola blood in a test tube and look at it, you see that the blood is destroyed. Its red cells are broken and dead. The blood looks as if it's been buzzed in an electric blender. Ebola kills a great deal of tissue while the host is still alive. It triggers a creeping, spotty necrosis that spreads through all the internal organs. The liver bulges up and turns yellow, begins to liquefy, and then it cracks apart. The cracks run across the liver and deep inside it, and the liver completely dies and goes putrid. The kidneys become jammed with blood clots and dead cells and cease functioning. As the kidneys fail, the blood becomes toxic with urine. The spleen turns into a single, huge, hard blood clot the size of a baseball. The intestines may fill up completely with blood. The lining of the gut dies and sloughs off into the bowels and is defecated along with large amounts of blood. In men, the testicles bloat up and turn black and blue. The semen goes hot with Ebola, and the nipples may bleed. In women, the labia turn blue, livid, and protrusive, and there may be massive vaginal bleeding. The virus is a catastrophe for a pregnant woman. The child is aborted spontaneously and is usually infected with Ebola virus, born with red eyes and a bloody nose. Ebola destroys the brain more thoroughly than does Marburg, and Ebola victims often go into epileptic convulsions during the final stage. The convulsions are generalized grand mal seizures. The whole body twitches and shakes. The arms and legs thrash around, and the eyes, sometimes bloody, roll up into the head. The tremors and convulsions of the patient may smear or spatter blood around. Possibly this epileptic splashing of blood is one of Ebola's strategies for success. It makes the victim go into a flurry of seizure as he dies, spreading blood all over the place, thus giving the virus a chance to jump to a new host, a kind of transmission through smearing. Ebola and Marburg multiplies so rapidly and powerfully that the body's infected cells become crystal-like blocks of packed virus particles. These crystals are broods of virus getting ready to hatch from the cell. They are known as bricks. The bricks